Hello, this is Andrew Heaton, and you're listening to the Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. The Reason Podcast is where I poke the brains of Reason luminaries Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mengue Ward, and Matt Welch, and sometimes they poke me back. Today we're going to talk about why Vladimir Putin is sweet on robots and whether or not you should fear them. But before we get to that, we're going to talk about DACA. Later today, Jeff Sessions will announce President Trump's position on DACA. The presumed outcome of this is going to be that he's going to end the program, but he's going to also allow it to operate for another 6 months. DACA is essentially postponing deportation against young people that do not have that are illegal immigrants in the United States, and allows them to remain in the country. There are certain things they can get, like workers' permits and driver's license and things of that nature. It affects about 750,000 people. So this is oftentimes decried by the right as amnesty for illegal immigrants, whereas the left and possibly libertarians, which we'll get to here in a moment, view it as a way of keeping in productive members of society that don't actually have citizenship. So on that note, Nick, how do you think Trump is going to ultimately go on this? And what is your thought on DACA?
If you take this back to the early 21st century when George Bush was president, he and the Republican Senate, particularly Orrin Hatch in Utah, were pushing the DREAM Act, which had a lot of co-sponsors, and it essentially would have come close to comprehensive something like comprehensive immigration reform, but especially it would have helped out young kids who were brought here by their parents. Their parents were illegal. They're technically illegal then. These are people who were not born in the country and thus getting birthright citizenship. Obama, you know, when he pushed DACA, I see it as something of a cynical act on his part, because he was arguably the worst president on immigration up until that point in terms of deportations and sending people away who had been here. But the DACA program, I think, makes sense, because part of the idea here is that you're prioritizing what types of illegal aliens or illegal immigrants would be deported. And what we're talking about here are younger people who were brought here without any volition. They have not, you know, they didn't willfully break any crime. And as long as they don't commit crimes, they're shielded from deportation processing. And it seems to me that that's a good thing. We don't have enough, people to deport every. I mean, just on a logistical level, we don't have enough to deport everybody we want. Why would you go after people who have shown absolutely no propensity to crime, who are totally acculturated to America? It seems to me that it is a kind of cherry that is being given to Trump's hardcore supporters. This is a wildly unpopular idea, and it seems very little possibility of working out well for anybody involved. I take immigration seriously. I don't make a strict determination between legal and illegal immigration. To me, it's more, you know, whether or not people are coming here to work and add to the country and add to their futures or not. It seems to me DACA is repealing DACA is a bad idea for all sorts of reasons, ranging from logistical to empirical to moral, et cetera. A study by the Cato Institute finds that it'll cost about $6 billion a year just to process deportation, and that we're going to lose something like $28 billion a year in added GDP because most of these people have been born, or not born, but raised in America, and they're actually contributing to the economy.
Nick, I agree with you on your position on immigration, but I think one of the primary arguments that Republicans supporting the repeal of DACA have is not so much the aspects of immigration that's happening, at least this is what they're saying, but rather that the reason that this program should be ended is because it was an executive action rather than an act of Congress, and they are ending executive overreach.
I don't mean to take out my exasperation on you, Andrew, by cutting you off, but it's like when Republicans start to talk about the rule of law and, geez, you know, you broke a law, that, you know, that they're illegal, et cetera. It's like, it's such horseshit, because every law, you know, raises priority questions. And just as it's stupid, I mean, you could technically say, you know, pot is still illegal under federal law, so we should be getting rid of all the pot people. It's like there are more important things to be doing. And it's particularly mean-spirited to go after fucking kids who, you know, like, when's the last time that you were able to tell your parents you weren't going to go to church or you weren't going to go to America or whatever? I mean, it's just, it's insane. And it really speaks to the lowest dimensions, I think, of Trump's political appeals, because we will not gain as a country from this. We will lose as a country economically. And I think far more importantly, we will lose kind of morally. You know, every developed country in the world right now is dying for young people to repopulate it. Japan is the worst case, but virtually every other majority, you know, every other first world country is under replenishment rates or replacement rates when it comes to birth rates. We want young immigrants to come here and to work hard and to make America, dare I say, great again, or at least, you know, keep it going. And this is just misjudged. And any appeals to the rule of law or the sanctity of the Constitution are horseshit on the part of dissenters here. Because you would have expected them, you know, there are any number of cases where, you know, priorities matter more than absolute right or wrong. And certainly in this case, I mean, we're just talking about kids.
Just look at Joe Arpaio. I mean, if you're going to pardon Joe Arpaio for, quote unquote, doing his job, when his job, as determined by a George Bush appointed judge, was systematically violating the Constitution, you can save us the speeches about rule of law as it relates to immigration in this case. I would also add, there's a thing going around on the Twitters yesterday that Donald Trump, as a private citizen in 2011, went on, I believe, Fox and Friends, his current favorite television program, to just denounce in the strongest possible terms ideas coming from Mitt Romney and other Republicans that they were going to be deporting kids. You know, he said, well, I challenge these candidates to come over here in New York and look into the eyes of families and tell them they're going to break them up. This is crazy. This is where Trump was in 2011. He gave famously the post-election in 2012 interview to Newsmax, in which he described Mitt Romney's policy of self-deportation as maniacal. And the key reason why Romney lost, Romney, let's remember, also, you know, was a big Joe Arpaio fan from way back. So, and also there's a, in addition to that, Elizabeth Spires, who used to work at the New York Observer for Jared Kushner, has written about and talked about how Kushner indicated to her that Trump was kind of playing the immigrant bashing game cynically, like with knowingly playing to a base that he thought could be duped. And on top of that, if you look at the transcripts of the phone call that Trump made with the Mexican president in January that were released about a month ago, get them on the Washington Post, it's very revealing to hear how Trump talks about paying for the wall. He's basically pleading with a guy like, look, I'm going to get beat up. I every day on the campaign trail, I said you guys would pay for it. So like, it's really going to be a problem. These people are not going to forgive me. So there's so many political chickens coming home to roost, although that is not at all, you know, the only scope through which we should see this thing. We're talking about 800,000 people, half of whom live in either California or Texas. So imagine that. Two of the people who died in Hurricane Harvey were DACA people, DACA recipients. I don't know what the right phrase is. They died trying to rescue people there. So the kind of not only did these people qualify under the program, but in order to do that, you had to register. You had to give a bunch of personal information about that. So imagine this, right? You have gone to the federal government and said, here I am. Here I am. I came here as a 3-year-old or even as a 17-year-old or whatever, but I'm legal. I would like protection. I'd like to be able to work. I'm a student, whatever. I exist here. And now those people know that the federal government is going to remove the protection from them being broken up. They already knew, and then some of them had already seen, that their parents were going to be deported, the parents who brought them in, because those people never had any kind of similar protection. So imagine what those people are going to do for the next 6 months. Are you going to be interacting with official institutions? What are you going to do? Are you going to go to the cops if there's a mugging on your block? Are you going to go to the hospital if you get hurt? This is ultimately the problem that people like Rudy Giuliani used to be able to accurately see 20 years ago when he warned the Republican Party that they're threatening to go the way of the know-nothings by their stringent politics towards illegal immigration and immigration writ large, especially in terms of sanctuary cities. Rudy Giuliani was a main proponent of sanctuary cities, which, after all, is just a way to say, hey, look, local cops are not going to be sharing all this information with who they interact with the feds, because otherwise local immigrant communities are not going to interact with local cops, and that's bad for crime. Well, that was a normal thing for Giuliani to say 20 years ago. Now he's out there, you know, on the campaign trail giving speeches for Donald Trump, wearing a MAGA hat, talking about making Mexico great again. So it's a real devolution of the Republican Party in general and in American politics that we've gotten to this point.
Matt, can you pinpoint when exactly the Republican Party just started hardcore leaning into an anti-immigrant stance? Because as I recall, during the 80s, Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush were arguing about who was more pro-immigrant during the Republican primaries. And even during George W. Bush, there were efforts to bring in more immigrants and to make a workers program for people already here. And apparently Giuliani, which is new to me. Is this just a cynical push that the Republican Party is doing, or is it just lending its energies to the more vocal and energetic populist base that's ascendant right now?
There, it really started, the anti-immigration push in general in this country started in the early 90s when we had the end of the Cold War, the beginning of a recession, which turned out to be kind of mild, but it hurt people, and successful short-term successful anti-immigration politics in the state of California under Pete Wilson. And so people were talking about this. It's not just Republicans either in the early 90s. If you go to Bill Clinton's 1996 speech at the Democratic Party convention and also the Democratic Party platform there, you can cut and paste it into modern day Donald Trump. It's like, we don't have a border. These gangbangers and thugs are coming across and bringing their drugs, and we're gonna stop all that going on. So in moments of, yes, economic anxiety and also kind of upheaval, people went in that direction. Whenever there was a Reagan or a Bush in the White House, Republicans were more likely to talk about, in Reagan's words, opening the borders both ways, or treating illegal immigration like a prohibition problem rather than a criminality problem. But whenever it wasn't a Reagan or a Bush, that's when things flipped. Nick was talking about the Dreamers and Orrin Hatch. Here's an indication of all this. One of the big co-sponsors of the DREAM Act back in the mid-90s and also of comprehensive immigration reform was John McCain, senator from Arizona. And what did he do after almost being bounced out of the presidential primary race in 2007 by Mitt Romney campaigning on him about immigration? He dropped his support for comprehensive immigration reform, voted against the DREAM Act that he had co-sponsored, and then over the next 3 years started talking about how we need to build the dang fence. So I think it's a combination of this stuff started happening in the early mid-90s, and I think there's a second wave that comes after 9/11 of people having this sense of, you know, there was a Michelle Malkin wrote a book about defensive internment about Muslim immigrants, but a lot of the point of what she was arguing is that we have this porous border in the South, and you know the Arabs can come right through there, and God knows what can happen. And so I think a Republican Party politics got sort of captured there by the populist base, and Donald Trump sensed an opportunity, which is that Republicans like Mitt Romney can make nod towards this restrictionism, make nods towards it, and then once they get into office safely, they'll go back to trying to come up with some kind of comprehensive reform. Well, you have an entire generation of a base of Republican or conservative voters who are like, no, do something now. So Trump went to him, and now he is caught between a rock and a hard place. He, according to reporting, is saying that he wished he had a way out of this DACA mess that he helped create. So I couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Yeah, I think Matt is right that you saw, and particularly in California, and it's almost single-handedly you can lay blame on Pete Wilson, who was the Republican governor of California, who was running for re-election in the 90s and started pushing an anti-immigrant sentiment in that state, which was extremely popular among both Democrats and Republicans. It had the effect of basically destroying the Republican Party in California. It's worth noting that people like Bill Bennett, Jack Kemp, and Vin Weber who had started a group called Empower USA, actually went to California to campaign against Prop 187. And then George W. Bush, both in 2001 at Ellis Island, he made a very big speech that at the time, and he talked about how, and I'm quoting from it, 100 million Americans can draw a straight line from the life they know today to a moment inside this hall. He was talking about the place where immigrants were processed. Immigration is not a problem to be solved. It is a sign of a confident and successful nation. Their arrival should be greeted not with suspicion and resentment, but with openness and courtesy. After the 2004 election, when he won again, one of the two things that he was going to use his massive amounts of political capital on, one was Social Security privatization, which went nowhere, or Social Security reform. The other was immigration reform, and he got his ass kicked by the Republican Party. And I think what you saw then was at the national level, the Republicans were turning against immigration, which Obama picked up on for most of his presidency. And now it is a Republican issue. And it's very reminiscent of the way that Republicans and Democrats were talking about immigration in the early 20s. What's different is that we are in a slow growth economy as opposed to a faster growth economy. But immigration resentment happens not only when the economy is kind of in the crapper, like it's been for a long time, where we've just been moving sideways at best, but where major technological shifts are happening and whole industries are seen as being sunsetted rapidly, even if it's been happening for a long time and new things are opening up. But it's really objectionable, I think, particularly from a libertarian point of view, because what we're talking about here is, you know, do we believe in a world and a country and a local, you know, all of us live in local places where people can have the most options to become the fullest version of whoever they can be. And, you know, there shouldn't be a lot of focus on legal or illegal status, particularly. And again, we're talking about DACA. We're talking about kids who were brought here and we're just visiting the sins of the father upon the children. And that seems a particularly old world and anti-modern way to deal with something that is, in fact, not a problem. Immigrants, a positive immigration flow is a sign that you have a country that is growing. And it has a future. And when you start choking it off, and I say this as somebody who lives half time in parts of the country with very low immigration rates, places like the industrial Midwest, like Ohio, the parts of Ohio that have the fewest number of immigrants, like Iowa, like the Dakotas, et cetera, these are the places that are dying on the vine because they don't have any kind of future and nobody wants to live there.
Catherine, I want to turn to you for a moment. One of the conversations that I think happens within libertarianism is whether or not we should be pro-immigrant and have porous borders, or whether borders are a wrongful concept in and of themselves perpetrated by the social construct, which is the state. Do you think there should be any type of quota on immigrants coming in? Do you think that there should be systems to process them? Or is this something where anyone that wants to come in that's not dangerous or perceived to be dangerous should come in? How would the ideal Catherine Mangu Ward immigration setup be?
So it's always fun to do the kind of utopian thought experiment. I think on some level, the absolutely extreme view of borders are bullshit and fuck 'em is something that I am happy to subscribe to. In the reality that we live in, though, there are so many ways to be less moronic about immigration, and the DACA debate is a great example of that. So this is the lowest hanging fruit, the most commonsensical thing. Okay, let's just let kids who were dragged in by their parents, like by their ear across the border, because actually about 75% of the Dreamers or of the DACA beneficiaries are Mexican. Let's just let those innocent souls hang out here in our country. If we can't agree on that, it feels sort of insane to even talk about more substantial immigration reform, which is unfortunate because, among other things, this point that we were talking about earlier that we essentially tricked people. We said, it's fine. Give us your names. Tell us where you are. Check in with us. We will give you all these benefits in exchange and we will treat you like human beings. And now we are going to use that exact same list to turn around and deport people. That's what undermines the rule of law. I mean, you know, screw Arpaio. The idea of opposition to gun registries is based on exactly the same idea. Oh, don't worry. Just tell us you have a gun. Tell us exactly what kind it is. Tell us exactly where it is. We'll definitely let you keep it, though. Don't worry about that. Just kidding. We're coming to your house armed to take it away. And that is that's so poisonous. It's so awful. I also think the political football angle of this is ridiculous. You know, the 6-month period, which Trump is rumored to be imposing here, is just a dare to Congress. Okay, maybe it shouldn't have been done by executive order. In fact, it definitely shouldn't have been done by executive order. It should have been done by Congress. Here's 6 months, Congress, get it together. But also you have six other priorities due to your ridiculous procrastination. So throwing this at, you know, into Paul Ryan's lap and saying, you solve it. Is the coward's way out.
And Paul Ryan, by the way, did, when DACA was first announced, he went on a media tear talking about how absolutely it's unconstitutional, it's awful, et cetera. So if there's one minor benefit of all of this, it will be to see Paul Ryan, who has been such a failure as a party leader, as a Speaker of the House, twist in the wind a little bit on this. And of course, that's ridiculous because we're talking about actual human beings, you know, who have lives. So but this is where it's going to come back to bite, I think, a feckless House, you know, Republican caucus, as well as a Senate caucus that won't actually do the work they're supposed to do. And under Obama, the Republicans made sure that they did as little as possible because they wanted to be able to blame everything good or bad on somebody else. And, you know, so it's coming back. And in a lot of ways, Catherine, I think you're right. Or you're, you know, the inference of what you're talking about is simply that, you know, Congress, it's been a do nothing Congress for a long time. And a lot of times libertarians are like, oh, it's good if Congress doesn't do anything. By the same token, if they're not doing their job, can we cut their pay and send them home then?
Also, the idea that we are now in a situation where the president can, with some justice, say, listen, this really should have been decided by Congress. I'm just throwing it back to them. You know, I think it shows the weakness of relying on a sort of strict understanding of the division of power and you know, similarly, in many cases here, the weakness of relying on a federalism critique, you know, saying that a law or a rule or a regulation is only legitimate if it's done under the exact right order of operations as defined by the person who benefits from dwelling on the technicalities in this moment is not a good way to establish law. And again, for people who bought in, for people who said like, okay, this is the federal government telling me that they're gonna do right by me, I don't think they're gonna make that mistake again.
Quick final point, there's a census Bureau implication on all of this, which is to say, in 2020 and in the run up to 2020, the U.S. Census is going to take its every 10 years census, and people who are worried about being deported won't participate in that census, and they will have a historical precedent which should be chilling us all to the bone, and that is, census data was used in the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. The 1940 census gave information that was directly used as part of that. So regardless of anything else, we are going to, for sure, because of this and because of other things that the Trump administration has done, we are going to have a less accurate picture of who lives in this country than we would have otherwise. And again, we are going to incentivize people who are on those margins of legality and on the other side of legality to not interact with authorities in general. And there are a lot of bad consequences that result as that.
We're also seeing right now people already, ICE, already immigration enforcement, is realizing that the chilling effect of their presence and people's reluctance to interact with them is so great that they are routinely masquerading as regular local police in their interactions with various communities. And we've talked about on the podcast before a piece in the current issue about the Kurdish community in Nashville, which the ICE agents are going around in flak jackets that say police. And people, you know, perfectly law-abiding Kurds in Nashville now don't know whether to answer the door when the police are there because they're doing door-to-door checks for people who are now eligible for deportation under a different Trump finagling of some Obama era agreements. But, you know, the sheer idea that totally law abiding legal immigrants would be scared to enter the door when someone who says police on their shirt is there is really poisonous.
Yeah, you know, it might be worth the people who are anti-immigrant because they tend to come from certain other positions. You know, think about it. If guys showing up at your door were constantly asking questions about things and their jacket said IRS on the back, you know, they'd be like, yeah, I'm probably not going to participate or cooperate. You know, can I ask everybody what, you know, we all broadly, I'm sure we have differences among us, but we all broadly, you know, agree that immigration, like a majority of people, like, you know, between 2/3 and 3/4 of Americans think immigration in general is a good thing, et cetera. But what if any arguments actually hold water against people who are like, no, illegal immigration is out of control. Don't tell me about numbers and don't tell me that it was some fucking kid who was 5 years old that we were here and that we've spent, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to educate. And now we're going to send them back to Mexico so they can compete against us in Mexico, stuff like that. But I'm saying, like, what are the arguments, if any, that can reach people who are hostile to immigration in general, and particularly illegal immigration? And, you know, nobody here is talking about defending, you know, killers and, you know, rapists and drug dealers, which Donald Trump seems to think accounts for about 120% of all recent arrivals. But, you know, is there a way to, you know, to talk to people that would actually change their position as opposed to just, I mean, I know I start to get more interested in venting, you know, my frustration at this rather than actually trying to persuade somebody to see things differently. Is there a way to do that?
Well, I mean, one thing that we did about 8 years ago in the magazine, thanks to Sheikha Dalmia and the late Mike Flynn, is run this immigration flow chart. We have a couple of different versions that you can find online, answering the question, what part of legal immigration do you understand, more or less? The incredible delays, the micromanagement, and the patchwork of kind of federal laws. If you get in line, what does that look like? People don't really have a sense of how arduous that is. I'm married a naturalized citizen now. I'm familiar with people who don't like it when the other people jump the line. So my point is to treat it more like George Herbert Walker Bush talked about it in 1980 of, well, let's talk about that line. Let's shorten the line, first of all. Let's not have incredibly low arbitrary numbers about things like low-skilled immigrants from Mexico, which I think now it's 50,000 a year. Before, it's been lower than that in recent times. You know, there are 50,000 low-skilled immigrants in probably the top 30 cities in this country, let alone the entire country. So we have to address that. I understand the rule of law concerns, but let's see what the law actually looks like right now and how it's being applied and recognize that it's all out of whack. And another thing is just to, you know, look around yourself and say, what laws have I broken recently? I was an illegal immigrant, according to at least two or three different countries at various times. The countries that have the most kind of strictures on immigration tend to be the least free countries, and it become difficult. And the type of people who are illegal immigrants are, by definition, they tend to be more law-abiding because they don't want to get caught. But they also tend to be more entrepreneurial because they either want to recreate stuff at home or they just have to work around things and kind of and create some new realities on the ground. So those are a couple.
I would also say it's the same logic that's gradually worked with the American public about marijuana legalization, to say essentially people are coming here anyway, right? Like, you can't actually control the supply side too terribly well, because we're a big country with big borders and it's just not viable, you know, big, beautiful wall aside. And to say they're coming here anyway. So the two realistic scenarios are not no illegal immigrants or the status quo. The two realistic scenarios are illegal immigrants that live on the edges of the law, operating gray markets and don't get preventive health care and keep their children out of schools and don't assimilate, or illegal immigrants who are immediately welcomed into the system, either formally as full legal immigrants and eventually citizens, or even on some kind of guest worker program, and who can fully integrate into law-abiding American society. And I think that argument has worked to a large extent with marijuana. I think you could draw a slightly less perfect parallel to gay marriage. So I think the sort of you can't stop it, so let's work to kind of mitigate the problems that you see, because most people will say, I'm not against immigrants. I'm against the crimes they commit or the resources they consume or whatever it is. And to say, listen, they'll commit fewer crimes and likely actually consume fewer resources if we legitimate them. That strikes me as an argument that can work and certainly has worked in my, you know, drunken hollering in a bar type experience.
Yeah, though, you do that a lot, yelling about immigration whenever we go out, just yelling, yay, immigrants, just yelling top of your lungs.
You put two gin and tonics in me and it's all, you know, DACA this, DACA that.
I mean, anytime, just to buttress that point, anytime you have, you know, even tens of millions or certainly millions of people who are on the opposite side of the law as written, that is a time to ask the question of whether you have a prohibition problem. And I kind of have that pragmatic argument about abortion, which is otherwise icky and I don't want to talk about it, but is that you're going to have abortions, just like you're going to have sex work. They're not the same thing, but there's certain. Yeah, exactly. But if you create these types of prohibitions, you are going to have millions of people on the other side of it. So that's a time to look at it as a prohibition issue.
Can I ask you guys, there is a line of argument, and a moment ago, Nick, you sort of brought up, are there any arguments that we think have legitimacy? I am not in favor of what I'm about to say, but it did give me pause when I heard it. And I'm curious for your sentiments or for everybody's sentiments. One of the sort of anti-immigrant positions that I heard was not rooted in economics and was not rooted in rule of law, but rather the fear that if you had a massive influx of people coming in from a variety of cultures, that it would erode social trust. The theory being that if you have lots of different languages and lots of different cultures interacting, people are more likely to default on police and courts to dispute, to mitigate disputes, rather than just neighborly interactions, and that this would create kind of a ghettoization of America, and it would basically atrophy civil society and cause the state to grow larger. I'm pro-immigrant, as are you guys, but this is something that made me think in that it was a new argument that wasn't hinged on economics. Nick, do you think there's any legitimacy to that position?
You know, I think historically you can look at various periods, because then that also, we're not talking about the distinction between legal and illegal, but if you look at the, you know, from the 1880 to about 1920, 25, and actually until about the Great Depression, but there was a massive influx, unprecedented and unequaled in terms of absolute numbers and relative numbers, of immigrants pouring into the country specifically who did not speak English and who had wildly different, you know, kind of cultures, because not only, you know, were most Hungarians and most Catholics and most Poles or Italians, et cetera, coming in, not only did they not speak English, but they did not, they were Catholic, so they were not part of the kind of Protestant mainstream. And there were also a high percentage of Jews. They were flooding into cities, which were ascendant and were places where these types of social trust questions become higher than average, because people become, you know, you're anonymous in a city, relatively speaking, and where you come from is less important or less visible, et cetera. And I think you can say, yeah, that, you know, there are some issues with that, but in general, the idea that that's going to promote people going to the courts or a decline in social trust, I don't think it's actually, you know, borne out by the past historical experiences. And in fact, what you see are a lot of intermediary organizations cropping up in the around the turn of the century. There were a lot of fraternal organizations. And, you know, that helped moderate and mediate how foreigners at the time, or immigrants, were assimilated into American culture. And it allows for, you know, more opportunities. I don't know about you guys. And like, again, I'm not trying to be romantic or idealistic here, but it's like, when you know, when there's not a breakdown in social trust when you drive by Home Depots or Lowe's parking lots and people are willing to hire day laborers who don't speak very good English to do work on their house. That's how you build trust and things like that. So I don't see any negative possibilities there. The one thing that is hard to say, and you know, it's very clearly documented if people are interested in the facts, that immigrants use welfare and transfer payments at much lower rates than relatively are people in native-born Americans in the same economic class. The one big difference is that everybody goes to public school, and that's actually the most significant tax outlay for most people in a given year. If you have a kid between the ages of about 4 or 5 and 18 or 19, you're looking at spending anywhere, you know, from 10 to 20 grand a year on them for each year of schooling, and that is a significant resource. We don't talk about, you know, poor kids, you know, sucking off the tit of the American taxpayer because they get to go to third grade. But people do focus on that with illegal immigrants in particular, not so much legal, but even there. And that's where you see some problem. There are times where fairly fast influxes of people, whether from other parts of the U.S. or other parts of the world, cause kind of logistical issues that are worth paying attention to.
And I would say, Andrew, sorry to cut you off, but I'm going to. There's a dark side also to your question, and I've seen it in some kind of minority strains of libertarian arguments as well, which is that these people who are coming in now in these concentrations and in these states, they lack our Western values. This is, of course, a very similar argument to what happened between 1880 and 1920, but somehow this time it's different. And so they're going to vote wrong. They're going to vote to have a bigger welfare state. They're not going to have our sense of tradition of the West. You know, a lot of people who go from flirting with libertarianism to flirting with Western chauvinism and even darker places, this is the way they go. This is the Ann Coulter argument that all these immigrants are coming in and they're turning California into a democratic state. Ergo, that's bad because you should vote right if you're going to be an immigrant. This can become a self-fulfilling prophecy if one of the two major parties acts in a certain way towards those immigrant populations as well. But it shows an alarming lack of faith in America's civilizing institutions. And I'm not saying that people are uncivilized when they come here, but I'm saying sort of the mediating institutions in life. We don't, the people who subscribe to these beliefs, I think, are terribly insecure about what it is that comprises the American identity. And they're flat wrong about what it is that can protect it. And we see this. Trumpism is an expression of that overlaps with a lot of nastier places in that sense of apocalypticism and thinking like we won't have a country if we keep having so many immigrants come in. We won't have a country if all of these people who are from India and from Southeast Asia, where they're coming from now, and maybe too many of them are Muslim, they're not going to have our kind of like a cramped idea of what makes an American or what makes someone Western. The fact is, in my strong opinion, that a lot of what we identify with as the West, as this successful experiment that began sometime around 1800, is as a direct result of the exchange of human beings and of goods between them. So to look at all of this, to look out onto this world and do as Donald Trump has done by making a politics and a policy based on restricting immigrations and refugees and all that kind of stuff in ways that are incredibly ahistorical, but also threatening to, we'll never trade again with China, I think was a tweet over the weekend because of North Korea. All of this is incredibly bass-ackwards in terms of protecting what it is that makes our identity. Our identity is rooted in exchange. We're talking to you, Nick and I, from New York City. What the living hell? New York City wasn't a result of some closed borders experiment, for crying out loud. There's a reason people all over the world want to come here, travel, visit, and work. It's because it is the new Amsterdam. It is the place of absolute exchange. So it's weird that we have this this large and kind of growing, it seems to be, or you know, at least in terms of influence, a movement in this country that is so insecure about what it means to be an American that they think that this fragile thing that could be overrun momentarily. They're totally wrong. And we need to win the argument at that level, because that is much more pervasive than just some kind of yahoos in Charlottesville wearing polo shirts.
It cannot simultaneously be true that Western values are world-changingly powerful and civilizing the greatest innovation that humanity has ever come up with, and that they will be undermined by 700,000 people who came here from Mexico as kids. Like, those two sentences cannot both be true. And luckily, I think it's the former that's true, as Matt has said.
Are you trying to become the queen of the cucks, Catherine Mangu Ward?
I already am. I long since have been.
Hey, Catherine, to go off of both you and Matt's last statement, is fear of immigration something that's just kind of endemic in societies? Is this sort of a xenophobic psychological fallback position that everybody has that we'll be dealing with and fighting forever? Or is this something that eventually we as a country will come together on? Or is this something where the Republicans 20 years from now are going to implode because they will have alienated all immigrants and we'll have a new party to talk about?
So I don't generally like to ascribe the views of people who differ from me to some kind of pathology or moral failing. I'm sure they have their good reasons. But I think more broadly, you can say fear of the other, fear of foreigners is a very, very, very human thing and an eternal thing. And that if there is any such thing as progress in history, it is almost certainly marked by a diminution of that the idea that the other is not just the guy in the next neighborhood, the guy in the next village, the guy in the next city, the guy in the next country, but you know, hopefully we can really move briskly into a world in which our fear of the other is centered entirely on AIs and robots, because that would be outstanding progress.
I agree. And in fact, we're making some progress on that front, at least congressionally. Last Thursday, a House committee approved a bill 54-0 that would bar states from blocking driverless cars as they come onto the market. And there were other aspects of this as well. I think automakers are required to submit safety assessments to regulators, but they're not required for pre-market approval. And there's a certain base level of cars that would automatically be allowed if this in fact comes to a House vote and Senate vote and becomes United States law. Catherine, who's likely to fight self-driving cars and the future, as you put it?
Well, I guess the people who benefit from the status quo are villains in every experiment. Teamsters, probably. Right. So this is actually, I think,
now
really
we get to whale on the left. Keep going.
I was just about to actually turn it around a little bit here and say it's an interesting problem for certain types of conservatives and libertarians, because we are squelching federalism. We are squelching laboratories of democracy in exchange for a single national standard in order to, you know, zip into our bright driverless future slightly faster. You know, I suppose in my perfect world, there would be a scenario in which we could allow for like Montana to totally ban driverless cars, or maybe Arizona if J.D. Tuchilli has his say, as he suggests in the pages of Reason this month. But, you know, all things being equal, I think this is good. I think the tangle of regulations is definitely going to get thicker and more complicated before it eases out. You know, for people who are super stoked about federalism, this is a little tricky, since obviously we want our driverless cars ASAP, given that we've been denied our jetpacks. But this is the heavy hand of the federal government coming down.
What about driverless jetpacks?
Yes.
I think that's a rocket,
Catherine,
isn't it?
Would you be upset if we had driverless jetpacks?
It's a rocket.
That's a drone.
Yes, a drone.
Or a
drone.
Yeah.
So, we have
so,
those already.
That is a concern that I have. I mean, I'm a big fan of anything that I can drive while drinking a martini. That's why I like horses. So driverless cars have great appeal to me. I think it's the future. I think it's fantastic. But I do have that kind of Goldwater rubric of, you know, have whatever problems arising dealt with at the most local level and reserve the federal government for the least amount of activity. So I have mixed feelings on this.
And actually, this new rulemaking does leave room for states to experiment with how they handle insurance, liability, ownership claims, taxation. So those are actually the trickier places. And I think as long as we can retain in particular some ways to experiment with liability, we may still benefit from federalism on the question of driverless cars. You know, who's when your driverless car crashes into my driverless car, how do the courts deal with that is something that is one of the biggest unknowns going forward.
That doesn't like it's particularly complicated, though, right? I mean, if whoever owns the car that's at fault pays for
I mean, is it? Well, I mean,
what if it crashed because of programming, right? I didn't program the car.
Yeah, I know, but you own it. It's like if you, if your kid is driving a car and you said, I didn't program him to drive into something else, you're still on the hook for it. You're insuring the vehicle.
Is that how it works?
Yeah, you insure the vehicle.
I mean, that's certainly one of many proposals on the table, but it's, I think, equally reasonable to imagine a future in which Google owns a fleet of driverless cars, which I borrow from time to time when I need to drive around. And how that works in our current insurance scheme is different.
Like Zipcar, you actually, when you, which is a temporary car thing, Zipcar owns the insurance. That's part of the price that you pay when you're renting the car. I mean, we don't need to go on about this, but I think that should be fairly easy because if Google owns the car and its programming fucks up, they're on the hook for it. Not that they'll have to pay it because they can hire and fire anybody they want all over the world, as we've seen recently. But can I ask about the federalism stuff? Because, you know, it's kind of like I almost raised that as a joke. I just reread Barry Goldwater's The Conscience of a Conservative.
Ah, my formative political text, yeah.
So, you know what? I'd be interested in what you think, because I was like, I hadn't read it in a long time, and I was really pretty underwhelmed by it. I mean, on one level, it's clearly the blueprint for kind of mainstream American thought. But he goes back and forth on federalism, and it's like he doesn't give a shit about segregated schools, because that should be dealt with at the state level. That's a federalist issue. But then he's kind of like squirrely about civil rights. Like somehow if you're a taxpayer, like, you know, do you have a Bill of Rights where, like, as a taxpayer, the state can't discriminate against you, which is exactly what was the issue in Brown versus Board of Education. And like, does federalism versus localism in a country now that has, you know, so much federal money being spent at all levels, and there is like virtually nobody going back to John C. Calhoun, at the very least, up through, you know, the Republicans and Democrats in the 2000 election, where they flipped their traditional positions on states' rights in order to try and get either Bush or Gore elected, or if Terry Schiavo is dying in a hospital bed, everything's up for grabs. Is federalism as a serious principle, as opposed to just a kind of argument, a relative position to win a particular legislative argument, is it just horseshit now?
I don't think so. I think we're all hypocrites, and I'm definitely among that score. And I don't spend a lot of time making explicitly federalist arguments, but allowing for policy experimentation within the broader bands of, does this violate the post-Civil War 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments? And there's a lot in those amendments and a lot of dispute over all of that, which Damon Root, our colleague, has written about so well. So it is kind of a muddy area, but I am happy, for example, that, you know, different states can have different ideas about whether they want to have fracking in their states, even though I disagree with the governor in the state that I live in over that issue. I think it's okay for local polities to have different ideas about marijuana,
I'm not saying it has to be like super, you know, like there's only one law for the entire country or something, but like, you know, anybody who cites federalism as, you know, a reason to invalidate like Congress saying, you know what, let's have some experimentation with driverless cars, I got a feeling that they're full.
Well,
of
I
shit.
Mean, in this, in this specific case here, I mean, what is that famous word in the Constitution? Interstate commerce? That's a thing, and driverless cars are going to affect that. Not just that, they're going to affect it in a massive way. Depending on who you ask and the timetables. We're talking about long haul trucking is going to not have long haul truckers here in, you know, 10 years, 5 years or 20 years. That's a huge industry shift, which also will get
a federal government is right in this case. There's no federalist argument against it.
Yeah, right. So for me, the federalist relaying this seems to be what we're doing right now. Like if you want to deal with, you know, local insurance requirements or these kind of stuff, you can set those rules yourself. but let's not completely, you know, ban this thing that's happening. There will be driverless cars going through your state. That's going to happen. And I think it's absolutely appropriate for the federal government to say, we're going to do that. We're figuring out the rules as we go. But you are going to have non-humans with vehicles going through your state. Deal with
it. I'm going to swing for the ghost of Goldwater. Nick, to your earlier question, I think that federalism is a legitimate political position for two reasons. One, the idea that I have more influence and control over my local government than I do over the national government. It's anybody here, anybody listening to your podcast.
You are naive. You live
but,
in New York.
Hold on, but
what possible but
my ability
to
meet with the local bureaucrat that is running for office that lives in my neighborhood is vastly easier than me meeting with my congressman. And my ability to meet with three or four state legislators and state senators is better than my ability to try and convince four congressmen to do something. So I think that there's something that there's a local control argument to be made. But the other one beyond that is that I think particularly now in the age of Trump, when we're seeing a kind of disdain for parliamentary constraint, the balance between decentralized and centralized government also has an implicit checks and balances element to it, where you've got multiple polities that are bases of power in part to keep the federal government from becoming too powerful. And I think that's a legitimate position.
I mean, I like that argument in its conception, but then people will say, and I think there's some truth to this, that with the direct election of senators, for instance, with the IRS code that allows people to deduct state and local taxes from their taxes, you've essentially robbed federalism of any significant meaning. Because the fact is that New York State residents get to deduct massive taxes, from their federal taxes. So the ability to have really significant tax competition in the U.S. is almost completely degraded, really. And you get that with a lot of other stuff. But then on the flip side, what counts as an essential right, as Matt was talking about under the post-Civil War Civil Rights Amendments, should a state have the right to, or a local town, because, you know, they're the ones who know. Should they have a right to discriminate against, students based on the basis of race, creed, color, gender, academic ability, et cetera? It just seems to me that almost in every case when we start talking about federalism, the people who talk the loudest in favor of, like, this isn't an issue for the federal government, it's because they don't care about the issue or they want a specific outcome. And then the next time around, the federalist becomes an arch anti-federalist. Or rather becomes a central government. No, this is a universal human right. And so you get people like Ron Paul and others who are super, let's devolve government, let's have little government. And then every year they're introducing a life begins at the moment of conception amendment or law that would ban all abortion everywhere forever and ever. It just strikes me as an arguing tactic rather than any kind of profound political dynamic that's absurd.
Well, unfortunately, you're right about that. There are a lot of people that have ominous or dark goals that are masquerading federalism as a way to shield them and circumnavigate it.
I don't even think it's ominous or dark.
I was thinking in terms of states' rights being sort of a code word.
Voting is a state issue.
Yeah. But by that same token, though, it does seem to me, Nick, that you can make a distinction between rights which cannot be abrogated that are inalienable, are yours before you enter any type of social contract, and those are more or less what we enshrine in the Constitution, versus regulatory rules where speed limits that you don't have a 100% right to speed whatever speed you want. And that's the kind of thing that the state can moderate that and probably should, as opposed to the federal government. Although I probably picked a poor metaphor given that we are dealing with roads, which are interstate.
I think the regulatory question and things like that. I'm just saying that when people bring up federalism, it's hard to take seriously except as an argument tactic for a particular political battle, not as a serious principle that anybody really gives a shit about.
I think it's a serious principle, but I think that we become such kind of a marble cake country that actually having a clear delineation at this point is very difficult, if not if not an argument of yesteryear that's already been lost. I will, for the moment, turn the topic back to AI, although I've enjoyed discussing federalism, and my family's going to be thrilled that I was defending Barry Goldwater's positions. With AI, we've got driverless cars that represent the kind of the shiny new future that we're moving towards. Everybody's very excited about it. We've also, in this last week, had other politicians and luminaries kind of come out swinging against artificial intelligence, or at least had very foreboding perceptions of it. Vladimir Putin, when addressing a group of students, said that whoever dominates artificial intelligence is going to dominate the world, and that, you know, for that reason, we should be very careful with it. And he also claimed that Russia would, of course, distribute whatever technology it had AI-wise with the rest of the countries of the world to ensure that no hegemony exists, which is a separate issue. Meanwhile, you had Elon Musk going on Twitter saying that we need to really, really worry about AI because this could be the source of a World War III level conflict were it to happen. Catherine, you strike me as a techno-optimist. Am I right in thinking that? Are you suspicious of Elon Musk's fear of an AI takeover?
You know, I'm kind of torn here between my love of Elon Musk and my love of AI, because I just hate to see my dudes disagreeing. But yeah, I mean, I think Putin is in some sense right, you know, when he says that whoever is the leader in the sphere of AI will become the ruler of the world, which is a phrase I just never want to hear from Putin's lips ever. But, you know, I think in some ways, you know, I'm kind of ultimately just fully in the Ray Kurzweil type camp here. I think that true AI implemented on a large scale is going to change absolutely everything, so that sentences like the ruler of the world, or even the idea that AIs might have national allegiances or somehow be the property of nations, or that the nation state will be in any way relevant to how AIs disseminate across the globe. My feeling is like everything's going to be up for grabs. And it shows a sort of lack of imagination on the part of Putin to sort of imagine that Russia can own AI. And of course, he's rhetorically saying, oh, we're going to share, it's fine. But he's full of it, as we know. You know, I think Musk is a little closer to the mark when he says, you know, this could lead to massive conflict, though, again, I am very skeptical of the idea that that conflict will originate in an intra-nation state battle. I guess I'm kind of looking forward to the World War III that's raging between, you know, Amazon and Google and, like, you know, Tesla, and probably as spans across three or four planets. Like, that should be cool. So, yeah, I guess I am a techno-optimist in that I believe that the power of technological innovation is enormous. And I think that there is some possibility that it will be good for us meat-based humans. But I mostly think it will be the end of the nation state.
I agree with Catherine almost completely. And, you know, one of the things to remember about Vladimir Putin is that whatever he says, it's not just that he's lying, but it's like he's the leader of an essentially failed state. And we need to, you know, the idea that AI alone is going to rule the world, et cetera, is misbegotten to begin with. But recognize, too, that, like, we're in the grip of an anti-Russia hysteria where, for a lot of reasons, most of which are bullshit, we feel a need to have a Soviet Union. The United States is you know, it's lonely as a hegemon, and we're constantly trying to build up in the American press and in the American consciousness the threat of Russia to America and to the American way of life, whereas Russia can't even do anything against Europe proper. There's no question that Russia is playing around with a lot of stuff with the old Soviet Union borders and things like that, which kind of makes sense. And I'm not saying it's good or that Putin is a good guy or anything like that, but it's a sphere of influence thing. The whole idea of Putin talking about this, I think, as much as anything, is to get into the head of Americans to be like, oh, my God, we need to have a technological arms race against him because of this and that and the Russian hacking of the election, when there is, so to date, there is no good evidence that anybody outside of, you know, the fever swamps of Hillary Clinton's top, you know, apparatchiks have seen that somehow Russia threw the American election and things like that. I wouldn't worry about Putin, and I wouldn't worry about that kind of stuff. AI, and also Elon Musk is doing what every great entrepreneur is doing, is that he's got some lead and a lot of interest in this category, and now he is pleading not just to the American government, but to the United Nations, to the world government, to freeze things in place until he and a bunch of his friends can come up with the perfect set of regulations that will regulate the introduction of this technology, of which he will be a main beneficiary. For me, the story over the last week that cracked me up, and I think goes to some of this, is that Alphabet, the parent company of Google, along with Campbell Soup, finally pulled the plug on their bullshit juice machine, Juicero. Even at the same time as Google had somebody fired from the New America Foundation, a kind of centrist liberal or progressive think tank, because the guy was in support of an antitrust ruling against Google in Europe. These companies, never end up surviving very long if they are using a technology that is not wildly helpful and successful to people. Good technologies persist because they help humans live better, more interesting, kind of richer lives. So a lot of the fear about AI is misplaced. And I think as Reason's science correspondent Ronald Bailey said, Musk is essentially calling for the precautionary principle to be enacted against AI, the idea that you should never do anything first and that everything has to be thoroughly checked out and vetted by various types of government bureaucracies or non-governmental organizations. That's a path back to a dark ages. It's not a path to a better future where people live longer, happier, more interesting lives.
There's also a certain amount of kind of sputnikery in here, which I think is probably instructive. I mean, the space race, although many people still drive a huge amount of kind of national pride from the results of that, didn't actually yield anything for humanity of much worth. And, this idea that we as a nation need to hustle so that we can have the AIs before the Ruskies or something, it's so totally misguided about the power of that technology. And I think only now, decades and decades later, are we seeing payoff from human presence in space in the form of satellites and hopefully eventually the sort of uptick in action from the private sector space companies. But, this sort of, yes, precautionary principle, but also rah-rah USA and our like red, white and blue AI is, that's in some ways that makes me think, it makes me think that maybe AIs are less revolutionary than I envision and hope if we keep them sort of small and caged like late stage dragons in the Targaryen past.
Well, they're good as long as they're thumb spinners.
I don't know what any of you people are talking about. I would just add that
I don't 20
years ago, I can't tell you the number of crappy ribbon cuttings I went to create the next Silicon Valley of fill in the blank crappy country or region of a country thereof, in which a bureaucrat thought that they could nationalistically harvest and recreate this thing that happened in the Bay Area of the United States without a whole lot of central government planning. I think the funniest one of all of those, there's a region in Hungary. It's kind of the breadbasket of Hungary called the Pusta. So they're going to make the Silicon Pusta. And I'm pretty confident in saying that when we look back, there isn't a big Silicon Pusta out there. As an anti-Russia, not hysteric, I think I've been very consistent in hating Russia for my entire life at an even keel. It's laughable how wrong Vladimir Putin is. He's trolling, obviously, as Nick was pointing towards, and people are taking the bait. But our friend Michael Moynihan was just in Russia, and his one anecdote was he went to one of these types of things where like technology companies were telling him about this great thing that they're going to do and how it's going to bring glory upon Russia. And it's like, dude, that's not how it works. If you invent a technology worth a crap, that technology, by definition, is not going to be organized around bringing the glory to a nation state. It's going to be creating something that people all around the world want for whatever reason. It's not something that can be planned into existence. The end.
Please never, ever say the phrase Silicon Pusta again.
It sounds terrible.
That sounds like sex dolls are next.
Well, hold on. So I'm with you all on the idea that AI would not be this, you know, super nationalistic flag waving thing. But I think one of the concerns with AI, at least as I understand it from Elon Musk and the kind of more pessimistic camp, is not that it would become a tool of the state, but rather that whoever is at the forefront. Huh? Not even
terrorists.
A statism thing. That AI will eventually become its own thing. It will self-evolve, will reach the singularity and that sort of thing. So whoever is laying the building blocks of AI is going to set the timbre for it. Not so much in the sense that it would love America, but in the sense that we might, you know, program into it sort of Isaac Asimov-like laws, were we the ones pioneering it before it spread, as opposed to if China or Russia or some other country did it and didn't necessarily put in those same humanitarian stopgaps or a kill switch or something like that.
This is the same argument.
Human biotechnology and germline engineering and things like that. And I think it stems from the same thing. I'm sorry to butt in there, Catherine, but it's, you know, there will be a lot of discussions about this. And regardless of how much people try to do this as a centralized top-down way, in the way that Putin is pretending he can do, or the Chinese government or the South Korean government, It's going to be a decentralized and distributed technology, and it will work out the way that past ones have, where there is more common ground found, because in order for it to be economically efficient and viable, it's going to need to have shared conventions, which will moderate the negative effects.
Great. I'm glad to hear that. Catherine, any closing thoughts on AI before we kick it off?
Soon the AIs will be so utterly indifferent to us that nothing will matter at all. The end.
And I would like to say, for any AIs that in the future are going through this podcast, that we welcome you as our overlords, and I think I would make a terrific human foreman, and so encourage you to look upon me favorably. And with that, we thank you for listening, and we encourage you to come back again if you're a human or AI. Until then, this has been the Reason Podcast. Please like, subscribe, and rate us while you're on iTunes, and come back again.